us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
He's been very patient joining us now. It's Grant Newsham. Grant, how are you?
There's a lot of news that we need to discuss, and so I'm not exactly sure where you'd like to start. You've written some stuff, but much in the news these days are the things in going on in Hong Kong. So why don't we go ahead and start there? Talk to me about your thoughts on the president signed a bill. You often talk about the United States standing up on its hind legs relative to China, and this seems to be, in fact, that it may have happened, or at least there's some small evidence of it. What is the significance of the legislation that the president signed last week?
Well, it is significant. It's nothing else. Many of the president's critics, who are legion in Washington and elsewhere, were claiming that he was not going to sign it because he's a friend of dictators. He wants a trade deal, etc., etc. Well, sure enough, Mr. Trump goes ahead and signs it. Once again, these people are as right as they have been for the last 20 years. But it's a bill for which. Basically says that the U.S. is going to rethink how it treats Hong Kong, stop giving it special treatment, depending on how the Chinese government behaves towards Taiwan, And if it continues to smother the former colony's relative freedoms compared to the rest of China. And it also, I believe, calls for putting sanctions on Chinese officials that it deems responsible for oppression in Taiwan. So it's what about the most America can do right now to demonstrate at least moral support, but also for Hong Kong, but also it does have a certain amount of sort of teeth to it. You know, if the U.S. were to put sanctions on Taiwan or treat it differently than it is, effectively treat it like any other part of China, if the Beijing does not behaves improperly, that's going to cause some financial harm, not least to the Chinese government, but also it's going to have a much broader ripple effect on other business, which the U.S. and the West do with China writ large. So China could find that what it does in Hong Kong has a much, much wider, broader effect, a harmful effect on its other money-making activities.
Interesting. Do you think that so the United States has been so reluctant to do anything? I mean, as recently as last month, the president, when asked about the protests in Hong Kong, he waved off them. I won't ask you to explain the Ouija board that gets used for public policy east of the Potomac River these days, but what is the impact of this support, do you think, for the issue at large? I saw an opinion piece written, I wish I could remember, but I don't, said that the Chinese know that Hong Kong is lost. And I thought, nah, I don't think the Chinese know that. I don't think they play the game like that. So get your crystal ball out. What does this mean for the future of Hong Kong, and what does this do to the issue?
I think it helps to look at what America has going on with China as like a 15-round boxing match. And this is like one sort of exchange of blows in about round three or four. So it's still early. And so one shouldn't, you don't quite know what the long-term effects are going to be because there's a lot more to be played. But certainly America has not... The U.S. administration has not lived up to really the behavior of almost every previous one since President Nixon, where they've ultimately conceded to whatever Chinese demands are and been gone out of their way not to provoke China, try to accommodate China. So this certainly shows that America's still in the game and is in the fight and started just... which it just got into recently, and we'll see how this goes. But it is, I think that to me is the bottom line, is that this administration is going to still trying to defend U.S., Western, and free world interests in the ideas of political freedom, human rights, honest, fair trade that we think are important. But it has not come to a point where it said, okay, that's enough, let's cut a deal and go back to the way things were. So it is ironic that the one president who's considered criticized for being a transactionalist, for only being interested in business, has actually been the one who has stepped into the ring and has, on about round three now. There is a long way to go, however. What's China going to do? I don't think they know. I really don't think Beijing has an idea of what it should do to fix this, or what it probably knows what it should do, but it won't do it. It doesn't quite have a plan for this. If you crack down too hard, then the Americans start doing things to you that, based on this new law, they'd have done it anyway, probably. But if you don't do it, then the idea that people, 7 million of them, or a good chunk of 7 million, can challenge the Chinese Communist Party, that's a precedent that scares a regime like this that is terrified of consensual government, won't have an election, and ultimately rules by force. that, so they say that you're seeing them trying to come up with some sort of policy, some sort of approach to Hong Kong, that any way the Chinese government moves, they've got a problem. So we're going to have to see how this plays out, and one really is in awe of what the free people in Hong Kong have accomplished. Sort of a reminder to us of what our standards and ideas used to be, or they are, but a lot of people tend to have forgotten those. So we'll see how this plays out. You know, I say Mr. Trump has surprised his critics again. And one thing that plays into this, of course, is the trade negotiations,
right,
between the U.S. and China. And I don't think there's going to be a deal cut on these, just because I think what America's asking for is ultimately something the Chinese government doesn't want to do, and now it probably doesn't think it needs to until another election's held, and then see what comes of that. So I don't think much is going to come of that. Perhaps Mr. Trump knew that or recognized it and said, okay, we're going to go ahead with the Hong Kong deal.
Yeah, you know, you and I have talked about that, and I don't know that how the Chinese system, which is perpetuated on the things that the United States wants it to reform, without forced technology transfers and all the things that go with that. That's the system. How do you say, yeah, we're not going to be us anymore, and we'll see how that works out. Well, then that's not how it works out. And so I don't, you know, the things that the United States wants from China, as you and I have talked about, are things that I don't think that the Chinese can have any part of. So it's interesting to think that maybe the president did, right, understand that and say, look, I know they can't go there. And what his people are coming back with and saying, look, what they're going to do is they're going to make the barest bones of a deal in order to placate us, hoping that we'll do what past administrations have, and that is, you know, use that as a pretext to give them what they want, or at least enough marginal reliefs so that they can get where they want to go, and then we'll call it good and we'll look the other way. And it doesn't sound like that's going to be the case. If he sticks to his, and really, I think the economic news in the United States is that, guess what? The American economy has continued to chug along, and it hasn't become Armageddon. Holy smokes, because everybody said it was going to be. And so I think it's interesting, and I thought it didn't get a lot of headlines, but it was huge in terms of the way he had treated Beijing, as opposed to, you know, standing up. And then you saw, you know, people in Hong Kong waving American flags, singing the national anthem, and doing stuff like that. So I thought it was fascinating.
I do too. As you mentioned just now, the people in Hong Kong raising that American flag and singing the anthem, I don't see how one cannot be moved by that. You know, they understand what America is about, and I think our side, or a lot of people on it, too often forget about that. And that is, you know, I think it's hard to watch that without being, moved. And also going to, with Mr. Trump, if you recall that just a few days before he signed the bill, or maybe a week, he had said something about, I forget, it was like, I stand with the people of Hong Kong, but I also stand for Xi Jinping. And he makes these comments, and it took me, I think, some time after Mr. Trump took over to really not pay so much attention to what he actually says, but more actually what he does. Because if you follow his actual comments, you can get whipsawed, or it can be kind of confusing and also disappointing sometimes. But, you know, like the weather in some places, if you just wait a few hours, it'll change. But this was, when he signed it, you know, I thought it was a good thing. And, you know, we'll see how this plays out. But it is not, I think ultimately, what we are seeing that maybe the situation in Hong Kong won't be decided entirely in Hong Kong, but it's going to depend on what the rest of the free world does in regards to China, ultimately, just given the geography, the history, the political arrangement under which Hong Kong is part of China. And the Chinese government is going to get rougher, and you'll find that the It's going to be more and more intimidation and violence used, but probably not rising to a Tiananmen Square, sort of a mass suppression level. So it's sliding downwards, but certainly the people of Hong Kong have arrested the slide for a bit, playing for time, and you know, maybe they and we will get a break.
Interesting. No, it's been interesting to read the stories about how they've done it, and I think that's been fascinating. I mean, they use Bluetooth as a part of a certain app, and they link each other together, and that's how they transmit locations and what to do. They've also have a counter-intel element where they actively seek people that all of a sudden out of nowhere attach themselves to different cells, and they try to run them out because they know what they are. For instance, the Molotov cocktail thing that's happened. I was reading about that, and they said, you know, the protesters know that their greatest weapon is their activism and pacifism and the camera. I mean, just like civil rights in this country. And as those images go out to the world, right, that damns China and everybody who tries to deal with them. So they said the Molotov cocktails are not coming from the protesters. They're coming from people that are implanted in the protesters by the Chinese government, right, and that, which gives the police the authority, then the mandate, to use greater force to stop this stuff. And it was a very interesting discussion about how the counterintelligence element of this is that, hey, you form a group. You know everybody in that group. You don't let anybody who's not part of your group become part of it during the march, because that is what they're attempting to do. So it's very interesting from a civil rights protest narrative of how do we keep this thing together, how do we keep control of this, knowing that they will try to infiltrate it, knowing that they will try to make us look bad and then use that against us. So I thought it was very interesting.
Well, it definitely is. You know, one doesn't, you know, these things don't just come about spontaneously and keep going. You know, these sorts of movements tend to fade out. They just lose some momentum after, say, a few weeks and certainly months.
Right.
And the way this has continued and even sort of expanded and sort of gotten stronger has been quite something to see. I thought it was going to sort of fizzle a little bit, or maybe a lot, by, say, autumn when the schools opened again. But I got that wrong. But you really have to be impressed with how they've managed to keep it going. But the Chinese response has certainly helped. If Beijing had just negotiated on the first day, that they could have defused the whole thing, at least for a good long while. But that regime just can't do it. You know, they just can't do it. It's like getting a mob boss to try and understand why he has to negotiate, say, with all the shopkeepers in his area that he's extorting. Well, he's going to say, well, why on earth should I? Well, you have to do it. And they, you know, or even to negotiate with other people anyone he has to deal with. It's just not really in their makeup.
Right.
And that works to the protesters' advantage. But you've also mentioned this, and I don't think it's gotten the attention that it deserves, partly because it's hard to explore, is the use of police dressed as protesters. And I think there's been an awful lot of that going on. And I think some of the worst provocations what looked like the worst, quote, provocations, unquote, from the protesters, I think there's has been a very active, substantial police hand in that. And that's really is fairly standard behavior for any British-backed police, British-origin police force. And there's still a handful of expats in the Hong Kong police, all of whom should be sanctioned by the U.S. government as quislings. But that's another question. But the use of sort of police in protesters' clothing is a part of the equation that hasn't got the attention that it deserves.
No, the little green men, yes.
Something an awful lot like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why would we leave this to fate when we can go ahead and we can put our hand on it and we can determine how the protest will go? We can make sure that we have the appropriate cameras to film it when it happens, and then we can show it to the world and expose them for what they are.
That's pretty much it. And that's, you know, that using these sort of people like this is standard sort of counterintelligence activity, but they're overusing it. I'm almost certain. And I think just the evidence that they have, when you have videos of police changing into and out of protesters' clothing, well, that does give you a sense that that's what they're doing. But it hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves. But it is an important it's a piece of the puzzle.
All right. Let's talk about what you're writing about. What are you writing about? I won't steal it. You did a piece recently that I found pretty interesting. Tell everybody about it.
Oh, I wrote one about the success of China's psychological operations against the United States over the last 40 years. And I'm not criticizing the Chinese. I'm actually something in awe of what they've managed to accomplish, because they've managed to really defang the one country that could have stopped China from developing into an economic powerhouse and into a military force that could conceivably defeat the United States. And even better, they got the Americans both to assist and also to pay for it. And sometimes you do just have to step back and marvel at what they've accomplished. The piece I started, I was just going to have it, as I say, an 850-word sort of an overview. And I started writing, and I was at 2,000 words, and I hadn't even gotten warmed up. That is how thoroughgoing the Chinese effort and success has been. And also the extent of really complicity by Americans from all parts of our ruling class, that it has been so thoroughgoing. There's probably a dozen PhD theses to be written about this, like, in the next 6 months. It's really astonishing when you put the pieces together. And, you know, if you follow, this is what you do. Everybody knows the details, but to actually write it down, once you start, you run out of word space instantly. So that was the big challenge here, and why it took me so long is because I had so much stuff to try and keep it into some manageable limit was a challenge. And some people who've read it find it very interesting, and others say that as they read it, they find it to some extent funny, but also ultimately kind of sad and depressing at what we have done to ourselves. And then, of course, there's the, what would you call it, the China hands, the ones who got us into this mess, all of whom claim I don't know what I'm talking about. So that's the latest thing that I did.
Grant, what is this, what was the institute at Stanford that's full of, all these guys have married Chinese women, and they put out this report, about a year ago or a little bit longer, saying that, hey, the United States needs to wake up to what is the Chinese are doing in this country. And that was, and so when you now have think tanks in the country saying, hey, hold the phone, this ain't right. How did the country get so seduced I don't know. So that's the question. How did the country get so seduced? Is it simply the intoxicating amounts of money that can be made, and the way that we've seen China say, if for instance, if Stanford hires a dissident and the Chinese don't like it, the Chinese make it known that, hey, look, we will limit your opportunities in China. We will not be partners until that person is off your payroll. Right. In terms of Hollywood, we've seen, right, that you will dance by China. Not just you'll remake this scene. OK. And so there are times that people will cut different versions of a movie for different parts of the world. OK. That's not what the Chinese asked for. You will, Tom Wright Cruz will not have the Taiwanese patch, right? And you'll remake that for everybody, not just for China. And so is it simply the intoxicating amount of money that can be made there? And that has been the source of this. It's not really seduction, then. It's coercion for decades. Is that it?
That's a lot of it. What I sort of trace it down to is I think that the Chinese have used a combination of appealing to American avarice, which is wanting money, naivete, ignorance, vanity, and hubris. And also there's even an element of racism in all of this, but on the American side. I've seen this in business, finance, and the military, and even government. There's this idea that, well, these Asians, they could never be as smart as us, could never be as good as us, as successful as us in business. They can't develop technology like we can. They can't fight. They're not as good a military. They could never be as good as us. And I say I would call that racism that you do see on display, but that's a little sideline that sort of spices up the whole thing.
Right.
But it's a lot of it does, you go through it all, and you do see how money is a big attraction for large parts of what we've done. And that's probably an old story. I would imagine the ancient Grecians, the old Greeks, used to know all about. Probably cavemen knew about it. But that really is what is behind a lot of it, is money. But it's not just money. That's there, but and without it, I don't think anybody would give two hoots about China. They'd treat it about the way they do Albania, no matter how big it is. But there is a lot of money people think is to be had. But you combine, once again, this naivete, this idea that, well, China can be made friendly, can be made liberal and even democratic. And it's this willful blindness that makes people want to think of it as unthreatening. Even though if you listen to what China says, it's clear what they think of us, what they intend to do. If you consider that when President Nixon reestablished relations with China, it was about ten years earlier, they had killed 2 or 3 million of their own people during the Cultural Revolution. And yet there's been this self-inflicted insanity on the U.S. side to believe that, well, China really isn't, there's nothing really that scary or bad about them that a little love and attention wouldn't fix. And then people have gotten themselves to think that, well, China is indispensable. We need its help to fix all these other problems, global warming, North Korea, transnational crime, even though after, some long period of time, there's not a shred of evidence to suggest they really have been helpful. So it's this combination of vulnerabilities that the Chinese properly recognize and have played on. And the interesting thing is, it's not as if Beijing has to act like puppet masters. They kind of have to just sort of get the ball rolling, and the Americans have done the work for them. Which is, if you look at China, the Chinese Communist Party as a poker player, if the people across the table from him aren't very smart, they're showing their cards and even handing over aces when they've got them, and even helping them out with some loans, making sure they got enough money to bet with, even as they're winning. Why would China do something differently? Say credit where it's due, and they've had a very good 40-year run, and really it's too many people on the American side who are to blame, and it's not the people in, say, Youngstown, Ohio, or Fayette County, Pennsylvania, who are to blame, but rather it is what I would call that ruling class of business, Wall Street, government, or political class. And even the U.S. military, academia, and Hollywood are hopelessly subverted. The media has been just about as bad in overlooking Chinese behavior. And So it's, let's say, it's, you have to, it's not like all Americans. It is a, certainly there's an identifiable sort of part of the American society that does really deserve full credit for what's happened. And when you write it out, and that's what I've tried to do in the piece, it, you know, with a like 1/1000th of the potential anecdotes or examples, that it is, it makes, I think, for compelling reading. Unless you're one of the people who has your snout in the trough, in which case it may be a little bit unpleasant or uncomfortable. Although every one of them can explain it away.
Let me read you an email, Mac. I believe this goes back to Nixon and then the elder Bush, and the perspective that we have to assist China, and that as China becomes more integrated with the rest of the world, you will see its policies liberalize. Clearly, that has failed. You even saw internal documents that have been leaked recently relative to the quote, re-education camps, unquote, that they put Muslims in. Where was the world outrage and indignation? It's not there. Why is that? Can you imagine if any Western European, or God forbid the United States, was attempting to do anything like that? It would be hysteria. But the Chinese do this, those stories get scarce mention, and then they're gone. It's amazing. I do believe it started with Nixon and then was continued by Bush. And we sit here now with a tantalizing taste of money in our mouth, and we can't tell the truth. The crisis that the NBA went through recently. Those guys are the biggest screamers relative to social issues here in this country. But let money get in the way, let Chinese money get in the way of any of that. And look what happened. It was a disaster for that league. Now it's gone. Nobody said a word about it. And hopefully it stays buried. It's really amazing to watch. I'm curious what Grant thinks of all my meandering. Grant, what do you think? There's a whole bunch there.
I think what he thinks. There's not a word I would challenge. I think it lays it out. All I would say is that it's actually much worse than described. It says it perfectly. And we do talk a lot about money, and that does motivate, and as it should, motivates us to do a lot of things. But Mac, I think you live down in Southern California, and I think you've been to SeaWorld. Probably.
Yes, of course.
What a porpoise does when it thinks it's going to get a piece of mackerel from its trainer. You know, do all sorts of tricks. And that is what I have found Westerners will do when they smell Chinese money. That they will perform like that porpoise, and all the PRC has to do is hold it out, or this prospect of mackerel, and if you even give a piece once in a while, well, that's all you need. And it's just amazing that you can get what you can get free people to do, and to overlook. And as I think, as the emailer, the listener noted, it is that deafening silence about Chinese Beijing's human rights abuses that it really gets one's attention. You know, you remember all the fuss about allegedly detaining illegal immigrants on our southern border recently. You know, and that was just fury on parts of the other side. And yet, lock up 1 million-plus Muslims in East Turkestan. Nobody cares. Harvest their organs of them and Christians and Falun Gong and Buddhists. And nobody says a word. Or hardly. I will say that now, to their credit, you know, some of the press is getting some coverage, and there's been some very good work done by investigative journalists and others to expose this. But it took much, much too long for this to be recognized, and even now, so much of the international community, and I would say the Muslim world writ large. Not a peep. Just couldn't give two hoots. And like a lot of people who you know, say of my age and even a little younger, you know, we grew up with this, the expression, remember, never again.
Right.
That was a reference to we would never have another Holocaust where largely Jewish, but many others were put in extermination camps by the Germans in World War II and murdered. And this idea was, well, never again. The civilized world will not let this happen. Well, I think we're seeing just how serious people were about that. And I would say not very. Now we, they say that the free world, and really it's that part, the ruling class part of it, the elites, the commentariat, media, academia, they have their chance, and they're blowing it. They're just not saying a word because, the porpoise at SeaWorld, they smell a piece of mackerel, and this is unfortunate. You watch it happen, and you just sort of say, you can hardly believe what you're seeing, given the evidence that's available. And one would have to, even a moderately alert moron would be well aware of the nature of this regime, what it has done, and what it is doing. And to suggest that there's some justification for it, I just don't see it. I just don't see it. So the author, the listener, really got it right, and it did start with President Nixon, but has actually affected every subsequent administration. Even the Reagan administration didn't do very well towards China, which is ironic because it did very well towards Russia. But say it's affected everyone, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. And this is the first one that has actually, you know, got into the ring, you know, for what is going to be, a multi-round, say a 15-rounder, and it's still pretty early.
Grant, here's another email. Hey, Mac, I noticed that the Japanese and the Koreans, the South Koreans, buried the hatchet recently relative to their little kerfuffle. Grant predicted this was a South Korean made for television event. His thoughts on that? Was that resolved predictably? Yeah, I noticed that, Grant, too. I thought of you.
Every once in a while, something that I say kind of comes to pass.
Well, you know what they say, the sun shines on a dog's ass every once in a while.
Yeah, I, of course, never actually put any money on it when I'm right, but the invariably when I'm wrong. But the I don't think it's really a long-term resolution of the problem. If you once, and I think I've used the analogy before, if you consider, it's about like the Irish and the English, that you'll get some now and then the how'd you call it, the pain doesn't seem so great. No, the discord, the inharmony, it kind of recedes, and people are kind of, you know, breathe a sigh of relief, and then something happens. And it goes back to how it was. And I think that's probably where we are. It's a temporary lull, but it's a good thing. You know, it's not to dismiss it, but it's not as if the patient has been entirely cured, but certainly the symptoms have receded for a bit. And I think it is a good thing that if you get the South Korean administration sort of realizing that it had gone too far. And it did back off a little bit, which is hard for them to do, particularly this administration, but even more just the Koreans in general. But they say they did back off, and I think the Japanese have responded in kind. And there's going to be some talks that are held. And, you know, there is at a certain level, and depending on the people involved, there is a reasonable amount of enough goodwill for both sides to work together. You know, without, not perfectly, but certainly to get things done. And that's what we have an opportunity for. And I think the Trump administration deserves, as any administration, if things go well, they deserve credit. If things don't, they deserve credit for that, too. And in this case, I think there was some useful behind-the-scenes diplomacy being applied, but I say I don't think this is a long-term resolution of the Korea-Japan problem, but it's a temporary victory, and let's see what comes. There is a lot of You see it sort of, not surprising, PRC efforts to sort of woo South Korea and to, you know, ultimately try to split South Korea from the U.S.-Japan sort of relationship. But that's at the early stages, but, you know, bit by bit, sort of like a leak, little leak in your roof, it, over time it can have an effect if you're not careful. But we are seeing that that in play at the same time. But it was nice to see that last-minute stand-down. You know, and as I said, it's not easy to do for any government to have to back off, especially when they've been so ferocious about how evil these other people, the Japanese, are. But, you know, we'll see where this goes. But I suspect, you know, if we could be having this show 50 years from now, and we might be talking about something similar in terms of the Korea-Japan relationship.
It's amazing. You know, I thought about that. I think about that when I see, you know, the entire time I've been on this planet, the Israelis and the Palestinians have been at each other's throats, right? And there's been essentially very little progress made other than some ancillary progress around around the peripheral. I've got another email. Mac, it looks like the guy in North Korea is about to launch some really, really big missiles from what I've read here recently. Is that just his neglect and a way of refocusing the world's attention on the Korean Peninsula because he isn't getting what he wants and the United States has essentially ignored him? Grant, what do you make of that? Where is that going? Because he has, all of a sudden, he's not so important anymore. It's not a frontline story now. Where is that story going?
I think it's what's described. It's in trying to get attention. And keep in mind, though, that he doesn't do anything without sort of at least tacit approval of the Chinese regime.
Right.
But it's something we've seen played out so many times, is that, you know, he's rattling his cage. And, you know, it's so, I don't know, there's nothing particularly clever about it.
It's
predictable. But one thing that's funny, and I was, is that, you know, I think it was described in the news as a super big rocket launcher, something like that. And one presumes that what's coming next is a super, super big rocket launcher, and then add your supers. You know, what sort of... Boy, that'll scare you. But it is, you know, and then they show a picture of what looks like a HIMARS, you know, which, you know, what are we supposed to do? Surrender like Lee did at Appomattox?
Yes, yes, of course we are. What, are you foolish? Right? It's, no, I guess it's their PAOs putting out, you know, what do we say? Say it's really, really, really big this time.
Yeah, they don't, you know, I think they're doing much target audience assessment. But the, but that said, what they are doing, and where I think it is, it's always concerning, but where it is, you know, we laugh about it, but, you know, they're playing for time. And they are getting their weaponry, their, you know, their systems better. You know, they're making they're progressing the whole time. And they've also done, apparently have done some work with submarine-launched missiles.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they are gradually getting better and better. And at some point, you know, we won't be laughing about, we won't even think of laughing about this. So that's what I think really is a concern. This problem is festering, and at some point they're going to be good enough that we would not be able to just put a blanket over the whole thing. You know, they would have the capability probably of shooting something with something big enough, far enough to hit us, and as bad, also they could work over the Japanese pretty well right now. And so this problem has not gone away, and it's, you know, it has been with us, and I don't know how it's going to be resolved, but I would note that Mr. Trump's maximum pressure campaign, or the one that his advisors put together, was working actually better than anything that had ever been tried, and then it got derailed with the South Korean sort of love offensive in, I think, early 2018, late 2017. And now we're about back to where we were 2 years ago. with this.
Talk to me about the South Korean love offensive. That has gone nowhere. That has fallen flat. And nobody likes to see, you know, love offensive fall flat. So what happens now? What's next for the love affair that is that the South Koreans desperately, or at least the leader of South Korea, who loves Marines, I might add. What's next for that love affair?
Well, I don't see it going anywhere. Unless South Korea starts writing more checks and giving North Korea more stuff, and they've tried that, and it really hasn't worked. The South Korean economy still is not very good, and that's what a lot of South Koreans are worried about more than North Korea. So I don't know that the South Koreans have many more cards to play on this. In terms of sort of showing such a pleasant face and being so accommodating to North Korea that they reach a deal. I just don't see that happening. I don't think North Korea's ultimate objectives have changed at all. So I think we'll get a better sense of things, and at least for the near term, when South Korea holds its elections next year. That, you know, because there is a sort of what you'd call a conservative, less accommodating towards North Korea part of the South Korean sort of body politic, South Korean sort of administration or government or political world. And if they come back in, then you may get something more in line with the more strict approach towards North Korea that we're used to. But if you listen to what North Korea is saying about President Moon and about the South Koreans, it's not very nice.
It doesn't sound like they're overly impressed.
No, so I think this has been a two year delay in an approach towards North Korea, which I thought was actually working pretty well. But the Chinese, I think any idea that Kim might have had of cutting a deal with somebody. I think the Chinese put a stop to that very early on with those meetings held between Kim and the Chinese. So I don't think there was ever really any success, any chance of success. But we just spent two years giving peace a chance, and now we'll see what we can do. I think it's going to be a sort of a harder approach towards North Korea. But in terms of sanctions, these have never really been tried very well. There's been so many exceptions to this. Rampant Chinese cheating has been overlooked. And, you know, until there's a real crackdown on the sanctions front to include Chinese entities, the sanctions won't really work. And once again, that's part of the equation, that you also need to, you've got to psychologically brace yourself for the idea that, there could at some point be such a threat to the United States or to our friends that you have to use force. And that's something nobody likes to think about, but it is, unfortunately, it's where we've gotten ourselves into these days. And so I think I've used the analogy before. It's like if you don't go to the dentist early, when you can have a slug of vodka or an aspirin, but it doesn't solve the underlying problem. And by the time you do get into the chair for real, it's a much more difficult problem to treat. And I think that's where we'll be before too long with North Korea. And although, in the grand scheme of what's going on in Asia, Really, the PRC is the issue these days. And North Korea is a bit of a sideshow, but it is a sideshow that really could lead to some very serious problems if you think through what happens in the event of, say, just even one North Korean missile into Tokyo or even near Tokyo, that it would really upset a whole lot of things. So it's certainly difficult times that we're in, and again, I think it's only the early rounds of a boxing match.
All right, final question for you. Actually, let me read you an email. Mac, please allow me the discretion of broadening the discussion from the Western Pacific to the North American continent. Mexico seems to be in the same dance. The president of Mexico is trying to placate narco-terrorists with this, we're all going to get along and somehow or other be nice, and it's the nice way that is going to bring these murderous thugs somehow to a good place, and it's going to bring the nation to a good place. This confrontation craziness just won't work. I'm curious if Grant sees parallels between the Emperor's New Clothes approach to in Mexico as was used in South Korea. Grant, what say ye to the Emperor's New Clothes approach? It certainly seems like that. And again, you know, the president says stuff. It's like, why haven't we designated people at war, right? People that are pumping drugs into the United States and murdering people. Why haven't we designated them as a terrorist organization?
Well, if you figure out the answer, let me know. No, I couldn't resist that. But the question is very, it's the right one, and it's you know, I've actually been following Mexico for many years. In fact, in high school, 1 year, I got the award as the outstanding Spanish student.
Ah, congratulations on that. Finally, the recognition that you so sorely missed.
You know, if you wait 45 years, you'll get the recognition. But you know, the point is that I find the thing that Mexico endlessly fascinating. And it's just amazing how little attention it gets. You know, you have an insurgency, and it's been going on for a good long while, that, you know, if it was in some other country somewhere, it'd probably get more attention than it does, being just down to the south of us a little bit. But this is a real war, and it, in some ways it's even worse because it is the, you know, you've sort of just subverted the entire structure of Mexican government, and the armed component of it is, and the violence is kind of scary to read about. But you know how we deal with it. It's just an ironic. It's, you know, it's a challenge, of course, stating the obvious. But the in terms of the comparison to say the North Korea or the Korea Peninsula, but I think that is something that you really do see the comparisons. That, and it could be Korea, it could be the Middle East, it could be Afghanistan, Iraq. There's, you know, think of how many times it's been declared that we're going to take a new approach. You know, the old approach didn't work. You know, sometimes as well, the old approach was based on force and violence. So we're going to talk this out. And then they try that, and it doesn't work. And then they try go back to the sort of the hardcore approach to it, and it's yet without solving anything. And I think that's probably where we are with the new president of Mexico, that, you know, you listen to what he says and, you know, that, oh, because we, and it's like, you know, we tried fighting, so we're going to talk it out. Well, good luck. You know, that isn't likely to have much effect. And you can kind of know where this is going to play out. And it's going to be a few more years of what's going on, and going to get a bit worse, I would imagine. And then a new guy will come in with a new approach, and nothing much will change. So it's hard to be optimistic about what's going on. But in terms of being able to predict what is likely to happen, I don't see any real grounds for a breakthrough on this in the near future. One interesting sort of case study, though, is Colombia, which had similar problems. It always differs in the specifics, but basically Colombia was in similar strait in the early, for a long, long while, in the 90s, 2000s, and onwards, and they managed to actually get out of that pretty well. And that was, you say it doesn't get the attention it deserves, but they managed to do it for Mexico. You know, they got their work cut out for them, and it is worth mentioning that, how'd you put it, that, you know, a country isn't the headlines. and that, you know, you read you read about the incidents and you think, holy cow, you know, how does anybody even live down there? And so yet people do go about their daily lives, business gets done, tourists come, etc. It's worth keeping that in mind. So there is some, you know, there's some grounds for optimism, maybe not in our lifetimes, but it could be worse, I suppose, since it's early in the morning, kind of, I'll be optimistic, but it could be worse, it's going to be a challenge, and I'm not sure where, I don't see anybody on the horizon that has an idea for how to go about fixing Mexico's problems, but maybe someday they'll show up. We'll see, but it is just amazing that, you know, how little attention events in Mexico get in the United States.
Well, you know, to me, what's always been amazing to me about Mexico is, I mean, if you drew lots for where do you want your country to be relative to the largest economic power on the planet, you would say, well, I would want it to be relatively close. I could siphon some of that off, right? And yet Mexico... when you read, it's because of Mexico's corruption, because it hasn't instituted labor laws, all the different things that Mexico hasn't done that has kept Mexico from developing and slicing off a little bit of that in order to raise the standard of living for its people, and it just seems incapable of doing it. And I just find it, look, if the example of Colombia is a great one, you know, but that was the United States down there sharing intelligence, right, and driving that thing, and the Colombians doing the fighting with American advisors helping with electronic warfare, right, with some AWACS support and a whole host of other platforms that supported that. And why Mexico does not declare war on them and allow the United States to you know, and say, hey, would you declare them, terrorists? And we would happily take all of the intel you have on these guys. And, yeah, will there be a few big gunfights? But it won't take many before they'll get the message that we're going to throw us and, at times, American assets at you. And we're going to destroy you. And that drives them underground where they used to be. Now in Mexico, they act like, we bought the country, why are we fighting about it now? So I think it's a very interesting drama, and I do see the parallel between what the listener wrote as a South Korean example of, well, let's just play nice. But when you play nice with bullies, right, and again, I alluded to this earlier, you know, 5% of the world's population, an estimated 70 people died in World War II, you know, but for the want of the Allies, right, putting their armies together and looking at Hitler and saying, we will not have this again. Don't do this. Stay in your box that we negotiated for you. But for the want to do that and have thousands killed, right, 70 million people died of all causes in World War II. So, all right, Grant, tell everybody, where do they find your most recent article?
It's in AND magazine, A-N-D.
Okay.
I think that's like andmagazine.com.
Right.
And it's also picked up in Asia Times as well.
Whoa.
I think today's Asia Times. They're going to do it in two parts, apparently. But it first appeared in AND, run by my friend Sam Faddis. It often has some very good pieces in it. But that's where you'll find all 1,900 words of it.
Which is rare. That's odd.
If you read it, you will see why I never get invited anywhere. It manages to offend probably like everybody in the entire United States within the first 30 seconds.
There you go. We love that.
But it is, and I try to call it as it is, and I'm not trying to be mean, and you'll see that I go to great lengths not to actually mention names when I can help it, because
right.
I like the pieces to be about.
But I know. But Grant, if we can't discuss the truth, then come on.
But I'm saying I do name it, or I'll it's clear enough but I say I don't like to get into the sort of listing off, you know, people who are wrong. But
right.
I try to say you try to keep it to ideas, because you will often find that the reply, the response will be, oh, well, you're an idiot. You know,
right.
And so as I say, I'm trying to keep it at that, at a certain level, and not personalize this. Although, can you really do that? Because it's not as if bad policies and behavior don't. It's not as if people don't do them. But it, once again, you see, I try to keep it with the ideas. But you do, once you read the examples, you just kind of shake your head and say, "Wow, we did this to ourselves." So that's my. But that's where you'll find it, is AND Magazine, and or even today's Asia Times.
Got it.
The first half.
What are you writing? What's next on the writing docket?
Oh boy, I have a sort of a long thing to do soon about my favorite topic: breaking Taiwan's military out of its isolation.
There you go.
So I'm sort of, it's like smacking the pinata. Maybe one of these days it'll break, but you know, you have to keep hitting it.
There you go. All right, Grant, always a pleasure to catch up with you, and stay safe in Taipei, and travel safe, and we'll talk to you again.
Okay, thanks. So one thing, you know,
yes.
The Redskins are on a 2-game win streak.
How about that?
The self-esteem that I've got is disorienting. So I just had to throw that in.
All right. Well, you should probably buy a walker. That way you don't have an accident, okay, with all this dizzying World Series and Redskin winning. It's pretty that's a heady thing you got going there, so be careful.
At least till next Sunday.
There you go. All right. There you have it. Thanks, Grant.
Okay. Right, sir.
There you have it. Grant Newsham here on a Tuesday. Now, I know that we lost a significant amount of volume, and I don't really know why. Well, I know why, but I can't fix it, I think. That'll do it on a Tuesday, if you're just tuning in. I'm going to talk about schools, and there's hearings going on today. Yeah, my daughter's school had two young men have been arrested for making threats. Anyhow... there's hearings going on today in Capitol Hill. More families filing lawsuits, right, because their health has been damaged. And now this is almost a year. Those hearings happened in February. So it's 10 months after the fact. And we still haven't been able to kind of get this thing changed. So keep your eye on that. There's a whole bunch of news today. So we'll go through that as well. The other thing I'll tell you is something that really does piss me off, and that is school districts. They do not have the right not to protect our children. Okay? Hope's not a course of action. Okay? Hope's not a course of action. And across this country, you have all kinds of school districts who don't have the money to provide their own security. And they can't, because if we do that, then it's going to screw up the teacher raise that we're trying to give them. And nobody wants to see that happen. So the probability that we're going to have a shooter is pretty low. Everybody wants to get a raise, though, right? Right. That's the issue right there. Okay. So you don't have the right to roll the dice with the lives of the children that you're supposed to be the custodian of. So if you don't have the money, then go get the money. Go to the governor. Go to the president and say, we need a program. State, federal, and local funding to finance security for our schools so that this stops happening. Right? And in my case, evidently, it was two idiots with a BB gun who were doing stupid stuff on social media. Right? Other people haven't been that lucky. And when you're not lucky like that, then guess what you need? You need somebody to put an end to it. So, I've got to reboot my computer. But All Marine Radio will continue here momentarily. So don't touch that dial. First hour is pretty interesting. And then Grant Newsham, you'll hear him talking about Hong Kong, talking about North Korea, talking about Mexico even. So, yeah. Grant very proud of his, I don't know, what was he, the Spanish speaker of the year in third grade? Yeah, well done. Have a great day. General Furness will join us tomorrow talking about the large-scale exercise 2nd Marine Division just completed. And you'll hear about that tomorrow. Lynch and Kenny on Thursday. Hopefully the chef on Friday. We'll see. So have a great day. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio over and out.